On the eve of America's involvement in World War II, Frank I Am the Law Haig, then mayor of Jersey City for 23 years, had lost his luster as a reformer. A generation had passed since he took on vice, police corruption, and the big corporations. He was now being portrayed in the newspapers as a local dictator, even a fascist. Already an annoyance to FDR, Frank Haig became an embarrassment. With Haig's hand-picked governor, A. Harry Moore, unable to run for a third term, FDR suggested a candidate, Navy Secretary Charles Edison, son of the great inventor. Haig supported FDR's man, and Edison was elected New Jersey governor in 1940. To Haig's horror, Edison turned out to be a reformer. Edison decided to challenge Haig's choice for a federal judgeship, but the reform governor underestimated the continuing reach of Haig and the loyalty of Haig's old friend and protege, Mary Norton.
So Edison led a delegation down to Washington to oppose this guy at the Senate hearings.
Thomas Fleming.
And there was a great clack. Well, Mary Norton, who was the congresswoman from Jersey City and a great devotee of Frank Haig, she stood up and she absolutely skinned Edison alive there before the Senate hearing. She called him an ingrate, a hypocrite. He said, you ran for governor 2 years ago and you were on your knees thanking Haig for his support. You mentioned Frank Haig's support in every speech that you made in New Jersey, and now you're here calling him a bum. You are the most despicable politician I've ever seen in my life. So the judge, Haig's judge, got appointed, you know. The next day, they recommended him, you know, and he got appointed. The next day, when in Mary Norton's office in the House of Representatives, she got a letter from the White House on the blue stationery, the personal stationery, which is only from the president to his best friends and always handwritten. And it was one line on it. Dear Mary, you're a grand girl, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He stuck with the boss.
However, in 1946, Haig met his match. New Jersey's new Republican governor, Alfred E. Driscoll, decided on a clever strategy to modernize the Constitution with Frank Haig's support. Political scientist Richard Connors.
What Driscoll did was to say, we have to bring Hudson County within the family of nations. I mean, make this a bipartisan Democratic-Republican effort.
Driscoll proposed a statewide referendum on a constitutional convention and gave Haig control of the committee, restructuring the legislature, but not the courts. That went to Haig's archenemy, Arthur T. Vanderbilt. Exactly when Frank Haig realized he had been outmaneuvered, lost control of the courts, his protection and his key to power is unclear. But the very day after the referendum was approved by the voters, Haig, at age 71, 30 years as mayor of Jersey City, resigned and turned his job over to Frank Haig Eggers, his nephew.
The fact that he put a relative in charge didn't go down well with a lot of people, particularly with Johnny Kenney, who was head of the Second Ward.
Again, Thomas Fleming.
A very big ward, and it's part of the old horseshoe from where Haig came. And Kenney thought that he had sort of a promise or an okay that he was going to succeed Haig as mayor. His father ran a saloon, and Haig had started his political career in Kenney's saloons. So you know, there was a lot of basis for the fact that Kenney felt he was like the heir apparent.
In 1949, Kenney ran a slate of candidates against the Haig machine. His strategy capitalized on the discontent of the returning war veterans not about to march to the orders of an aging Irish boss, especially one pulling the strings from a deck chair at a mansion in Key Biscayne, Florida. Kenney assembled a slate reflecting the changing demographics of Jersey City, including the Italians and the Poles.
I was pretty young at the time, but I remember my uncles.
Barbara Petrick.
The Italian uncles, you know. They were war veterans, and they would gather at these saloons. But they would go there, and they would talk to each other about how mad they were and Haig this and Haig that, and they focused their hatred on him. And it was time for a change. And it required that kind of impetus, really, even at that day, to beat the machine, which, you know, had a number of... For every city job, you had a half a dozen people who were related to the person who had the city job, and you had to call in those votes. And it took a lot to overturn that core of people who had produced those votes generation after generation, because it was scary. You were risking everything. I mean, if you lost, if Haig won again, boy, you were through. You know, the assessment on your house was going up, and the secretary, the judge, was going to be fired. And, I mean, all those things were going to happen. So it was, you were taking a big risk, but that's exciting to take a risk like that. I remember it was like almost like electricity ran through the city, and the idea that Haig could be beaten. And you had to know how many times it looked like he was going to be beaten by muckamucks. These investigations, they never did him in. It was the people, finally, who did him in.
One of the climactic moments of the big election of 1949,
Thomas Fleming,
the Kenny Haig confrontation, that took place downtown in the Horseshoe. Haig invaded the Horseshoe. He was going to beat Kenny in his own bailiwick. And he was up on the platform giving a speech, and all sorts of people started waving banners in his face and shouting insults at him. And he turned to the cops and he said, "Get rid of those guys." And any other time in the preceding 32 years, those guys would have been out of there so fast, you know, and probably on the way to a hospital. Instead, not one cop moved. And Haig looked at them and they looked at him. And I think that was the moment that Frank Haig realized, it's over.
Though he had retired from the mayor's office 2 years ago in favor of his nephew, Haig still was the boss until Kenny's victory smashed his mighty machine. Now ready to move into the Jersey City City Hall, bailiwick of the discarded machine, new Mayor Kenny, a former Haig man himself, says,
"Let me say that one of the first orders of business in the new administration will be for a thorough investigation of all books and all records, all public papers in every department of Jersey City."
1949, Frank Haig found himself replaced by another machine politician espousing reform. The Irish street tough who walked among petty thieves and presidents, who ruled supreme for 32 years, was finally out of power. The last 6 years of his life, Frank Haig spent living well with his wife for 50 years, Jenny Warner Haig. Jersey City historian Bob Leach.
They were not bitter years. They were angry, but he traveled a lot. He and his wife went to Paris often. They maintained a luxurious lifestyle.
Frank Haig died a few weeks before his 80th birthday on New Year's Day, 1956, in his Park Avenue penthouse.
He gets brought back here to Jersey City, and he's given what amounted to a state funeral. There was a great outpouring of people. So he lived his last years, as he lived many of his years, in luxury. But of course, there was a tinge of sorrow that he must have felt. And there's some tinge of sorrow that the people of Jersey City still have in looking back upon that period following the defeat of the Haig machine in 1949.
It's been more than half a century since Frank Haig fell from power. No single person has so dominated local and state politics for so long before or since, in New Jersey or elsewhere. Frank Haig's era was different from today. It was a time when cities held the balance of power, when politics reached into every neighborhood and every home, when nerve and toughness were the coin of the realm. Frank Haig understood power and wielded it without hesitation, but not, it turns out, without remorse towards the end of his life. Tom Fleming.
There's a wonderful anecdote that his daughter told me. When he was out of power and out of politics, he was living over in New York, he had trouble sleeping. He'd wake up in the middle of the night and he'd start thinking of how things had gone over the years. And he'd remember some family that he had ruined. You know, he'd driven the guy out of Jersey City or ruined his law practice because he'd come out against them, or fired him off the cops because he'd talked too much in a bar against Haig or that sort of thing. And he would get the person's phone number and he'd call them up in the middle of the night and he'd say, you know, I was thinking of the old days, you know, and I was a good friend. Maybe get the daughter very often or the son or something like that. The guy might be dead by now. He'd say, I was thinking of the old days and I was a good friend of your father before we had that falling out. Is there anything I can do for you? And now this, you've got to be Irish to understand this. Every single one of them said, no, we don't want anything from you. As somebody said, the definition of Irish Alzheimer's is you forget everything but your grudges.
The Life and Times of Frank Haig was narrated by Malachy McCourt, written and produced by Marty Goldenson and David Stephen Cohen. The executive producer, Bill Jobes. The sound archivist, Andy Lansing. Recording engineer, Larry Josephson. Music consultant, Edward Haber. Additional editing, John Kalish. Thanks to the Jersey City Public Library, the National Archives, Sherman Grinberg Film Library, the Park Tavern, Vince Carroll, Jack Howell, Bob Ford, Kenneth French, Nancy Greenlease, John Rorvik, and Carol Selman. Funding for The Life and Times of Frank Haig was provided by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission. This has been a co-production of NJN Radio and the New Jersey Historical Commission.